Monday, March 26, 2012. The radio program is on the air. It's Primetime Sports, the nation's most listened to sports talk presentation on the Fan Radio Network on Sirius, Channel 157 on Sportsnet in high definition coast to coast. Bob McCowan, Stephen Brunton, our Toronto studios. Later on, Richard Berthelsen, the former lawyer for the National Football League Players Association. He stepped down Thursday after 40 years in that capacity. 40 years. Man, this guy has seen the evolution of the game, really, from...
Evolution of the game, the evolution of the business.
Of the business, maybe more than the game, perhaps. We'll talk to him about that. And then, by now, I assume almost all of you will be aware that we lost one of our dearest friends, personally and to this show, over the weekend. Burt Randolph Sugar passed away this weekend, and as something of a tribute to him, we will let you listen into a conversation we had 6 months ago or so. And it's there's been a lot of talk on Twitter about memories of Burt and his appearances on this program. We're going to let you hear what we think is one of the best, one of the most unique, and it was the admin conversation.
I think this, as I recall, Bob, it came up, his advertising background came up during an earlier interview, just briefly, as a passing thing, and you wanted to go back to it, right? You wanted to do a piece about him being
an advertiser. Well, actually, I didn't. I just wanted to talk a little bit about it. We were going to get to boxing, and we just, as you will hear in the conversation, we just never kept, we never really got to it. I think we did maybe at the end for a minute or two, but really just a little bit. And I, one of the saddest things as I reflect on it is I always meant to go back to that conversation. I wanted more of that. I knew that Burt had more, and I'd run out of time, even though it was about 17-minute conversation. I knew there was more there, and I wanted to go back to it, and now that will be, we won't have that opportunity. But we will have the opportunity to let you listen one more time to Burt Randolph Sugar. That'll come up later on. For several weeks, months now, we've been talking about the prospect of, well, an arena in Quebec City and then an NHL franchise in Quebec City. There have been those who have been skeptics about both of those prospects, and let's be honest. Nobody has stood up and said there's an NHL team coming to Quebec City. Well, we have, but maybe nobody else has. But at least a significant step, I would say, was taken over the weekend as there was a news conference to announce and confirm that the funding is indeed in place to build an arena, a new arena in Quebec City. Among those who have been following this story with interest, our friend Sean Gordon of the Globe and Mail joins us. Mr. Gordon, how are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're good. So, is there any doubt in your mind today that the arena will be built?
None. If it was a done deal before, now it's a really, really well done, burned around the edges, crisp deal. They're going to break ground on this. It looks, from my examination anyway, that they've got a fairly solid financial framework. Of course, as these things go, you know, that could quickly, that situation could quickly change. But yeah, I think they've got contingencies in place. They've ordered up schematics. They've got the site chosen. They've said they're going to break ground in the middle of September, probably toward the end of September, and that this thing's going to be ready in 2015.
Sean, tell us a little about, there's the press conference, the Dog and Pony Show was yesterday, Sunday, which is kind of unusual, but featuring the mayor, prominently featuring the mayor, and I guess Pierre-Carl Péladeau, who is whose company has bought the naming rights to the building and is, again, widely speculated to be part of any potential ownership group. What was they put on a bit of a show, and kind of why did they do it, and what was the tone of it?
Yeah, they did. Well, there's a couple of reasons. The timing, it was odd, you're right. I think it had to do mostly with the fact that that the mayor has to go. He's on a trade mission, I believe, in France. And he was leaving, I believe, today. And so they wanted to get this done. They had a deadline that they had set of March 31st to actually get the lawyers involved and to get a final contract that that could be signed. Because you'll recall that they actually reached an agreement in principle about a year ago, just over a year ago. So that kind of explains why they did it then. In theory, they could have done it probably when La Boheme came back, but you know. It's Sunday. There wasn't much going on, so why not, right?
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, it was indeed a dog and pony show, and there was much thanking. There was much thanking of the vision of Premier Jean Charest, and you know, and so forth. And of course, much backslapping, and my dear friend this, and my fine fellow that. And, you know, the usual stuff that you see in these sorts of circumstances. And I think that fundamentally, I think that this is sort of like the, I don't know if you want to call it, like, I guess it's equivalent. I mean, all it was really missing was the silver shovel and the ceremonial, the ceremonial turning of the sod kind of thing. So I imagine that'll come in September.
With Sean Gordon of the Globe and Mail. I see here by the story that the new arena will be situated on the site of a harness racing track near downtown.
Yep.
Construction set to begin mid-September of this year. When we originally reported this story, as we understood it, the word that we got was that the new arena would be virtually adjacent to what was Le Colisée, is now the Pepsi Center, I believe. Is this a different location, or is this in the same proximity?
It's in the same proximity. Essentially, there's a giant fairground that surrounds the Colisée. And they were originally going to build it at the intersection of two highways to make it easier to get to. But that chunk of land, which most of it's a parking lot right now, is contaminated. So they were going to have to pay $40+ million to decontaminate that. And Le Baume understands that his political future hinges on getting this thing built on time and on budget, so they essentially cast around for other opportunities. And this old racetrack, I mean, it's just kind of a neat idea. What they're going to do is they're going to maintain the facade of the existing track, and they're going to integrate it into the design of the new building. The new building is going to be a little bit smaller than what they'd originally expected, although that's mostly in terms of footprint, overall footprint. The number of seats is going to be the same. It's going to be 18,000 with luxury boxes and so forth. And Peloto is going to build a little office complex next to it. There's going to be TV studios and all sorts of other things. This is sort of seen as the shift of operations, if you will, in terms of a lot of the TV stuff that they do will be moving to Quebec City, or I guess they'll be expanding it. It's hard to move outside of the Nerve Center in Montreal when it comes to technicians and artists and so forth. But they're gonna take a go at creating a sort of media village, such is the plan anyway.
Sean, how did the mayor and Peloto dance around the NHL elephant in the room? Because of course they're not. God knows they want to say something, but they're not in following the Winnipeg model. They're not supposed to say anything.
Yeah, it's all sort of broad winks and nudge, knowing smiles and all that sort of stuff, right? I mean, this is kind of where they're at. You're right, they did kind of tiptoe around it because they have to, but all that happens is they get closer to getting this done, right? I mean, that's just all that happens. It just grinds along. I mean, they've got money now to fix up the Colisée if they need to on a quick turnaround. Now you've basically got a formal deal, a legal document. They've got financing in place. They're going to break ground on the arena, and it's just everything just kind of inexorably moves forward. And so, I think that they're completely confident that they're going to get a team, and I think that confidence is probably not misplaced. I mean, I'm sure that they have discussions that the details of which we can speculate on, but that are probably advancing, I would suggest.
Oh no, and I mean, it has been whispered to me, and I've said so here for many weeks now, that I've been told that this situation in many ways parallels that of Winnipeg of last summer. Where the people in Winnipeg were told in advance, get your dolls and dishes in order, get everything lined up, take the next few months to put everything in place. This is going to happen, but don't you dare say anything, or we'll undo it. And it is my understanding that the same kind of message has already been delivered and was delivered many weeks ago to the folks in Quebec City. The possible difference being that we are less confident that these guys can keep their mouths shut for long enough.
Yes, well, among Le Baume's great many virtues, discretion is not among them. Let's face it; he's a guy who likes to talk, and I would actually think that you're bang on, Bob. I mean, that there is at least some sort of, if not an assurance, at least some sort of, look, guys, just be patient and play by our rules, and you'll see that this will end well. I mean, it just makes too much sense not to happen, given the struggles of some of the teams in the National Hockey League. And, I think that, look, I mean, the Winnipeg experiment has been, I think, successful by any measure. Certainly a lot more successful than the last few years in Atlanta. So, I mean, it sort of seems to me that, it's a question of when rather than if.
Bill Daly was on with us last week, and you don't always get revealing conversations with Bill Daly. But I'm interested in Brunt's observations of that. Did you come away thinking that that's as close as he's or anybody in the NHL has ever come to saying Phoenix is going to Quebec City?
Well, again, without putting words in his mouth, although I'm happy to put words in his mouth, I think what Bill said was that they are, of course, still looking for that mythical Phoenix owner, but that he acknowledged there were – it's not just a matter of finding an owner. It's a matter of finding an owner, going through all of the hoops that we know all about, plus the Goldwater Institute potential challenge, and that all of that would have to be wrapped up within, what, 6 weeks?
April 15th, he said.
Yeah, so less. So
3 weeks.
So acknowledging that that would be a challenging timeline, which I think Bill acknowledged that it was a challenging timeline. He tried to make a case that you could play in the Key Arena in Seattle, but I don't believe that's actually true. And so – if they can't put it together in Phoenix and you actually can't play in the arena in Seattle even temporarily, that leaves an empty arena in Kansas City with no owner, where no one has surfaced ever. And what we're talking about, Quebec.
Well,
right?
And here's the interesting part about this, Sean, too, is that in addition to the announcement of the new arena, the city of Quebec City has already approved about $7 million in emergency renovations to the Colisée, which you don't do, really, unless an NHL team is coming and you need a place for them to play for a couple of years.
Well, and, you know, you're right. And I think that part of the, you know, the there was an interesting case of the timing with that announcement, which, of course, was made shortly after the Seattle speculation really came forward, right? You know, where you had the guys who want to build the arena with the NBA team and all that sort of stuff, and you know, and as if by miracle, all of a sudden, you know, Quebec City finds the money to do this, and you know, I think that was a broad signal publicly and to the National Hockey League to say, look, guys, you know, we're ready, right? And you know, I think probably they could make the Colisée a serviceable building on a rather short timeline, probably a month or two after the season. But I mean, you know, and I think that it's actually probably a better place to house a team temporarily than the Key Arena, just in terms of the seats. I mean, you got more seats, and it's, you know, it's actually purpose built, right? So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if this were to come together quickly. I also wouldn't be surprised if they decided to hold off and maybe try and rather than, you know, the old game of trying to squeeze more money out of potential owners through expansion fees or something like that.
Is Peladeau the owner, or Peladeau on a partner? He doesn't seem like a partnering kind of guy to me, but
well, if it'd be a minority partner, you know, I could see, like, you know, I could see some Quebec Inc. figures wanting to join hands here with them and to try and get a piece of the action. I mean, you know, there were always rumors about René Angelil and Céline Dion and all that sort of stuff when Peladeau took a run at the Habs in 2009. I mean, it could happen, although let's not be under any illusion about who's going to call the shots here. It's going to be Pierre-Carl Peladeau and nobody else. It would seem to me that a consortium is probably not outside the realm of possibility, but it would be just, you know, people who are happy to be along for the ride, be associated with the venture.
The other part of the equation that we have discussed for the last little while is the possibility, probability of Patrick Roy having a major role, whether it's as coach, general manager, or both, with the revival of the Quebec Nordique. To throw a monkey wrench into that, some of your friends in the media in Montreal decided to anoint Patrick as the next, coach or general manager or both?
Could be both.
Montreal Canadiens. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it would actually sort of surprise me if Patrick were to be involved in the revival of the Nordiques, if only because he was actually fairly vocal about, you know, he's one of the rare people, you know, other than LeBohm's political opponents, who are actually saying this is a really bad idea, and it's a bad idea if you make lots of money from owning a junior team.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only game in town. Look, his personal history, of course, is with the Habs and with the Colorado Avalanche, and you know, I know that there was talk of a possible trade involving Patrick to the Nordiques way back when, but it's, you know, yeah, he's a Quebec City guy, but I think it's the sort of situation where I don't know necessarily that he has any kind of links to the Peladeau gang. I mean, he may not. I don't know. I actually think that it's more likely if he's going to make a move to the NHL. I'm going to guess that it's going to happen really soon. Quite frankly, I mean, if Pierre-Carl Peladeau were to pick up the phone and say, you know, hey, by the way, I've heard on the QT that we're going to get a team, and would you like to not have to move? You know, maybe he'll consider it. But I actually think that anything that does happen with Patrick Roy, and of course it's still just rumors at this stage, but I think anything that does happen with Patrick Roy is probably going to happen over the next 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think it's Quebec, too. I don't think it's Montreal. But we will see. You win some, you lose some. Sean, always good to take time for us. Thanks, pal.
You're most welcome, guys.
Sean Gordon of the Globe and Mail joining us from Montreal. Again, arena deal done in Quebec City. Renovations to the old barn, ready to go. The money's been appropriated for that. We'd heard $30 million, now it's $7 million, but whatever it costs, it costs. Again, more signs of what we believe is the inevitable, the return of the National Hockey League to Quebec City.
And no signs anywhere else, Bob. The absence of signs in other places.
There's no there anywhere else. The break, and then more. Primetime continues. You're listening on the Fan Radio Network on Sirius, watching on Sportsnet. Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius, and coast-to-coast on Sportsnet in high definition. Bob McCowan, Stephen Brund a little bit later on. Replay of a one of the last interviews we did with Burt Randolph, Sugar. And we, if you didn't hear it, even if you did hear it, come back, stick around, and listen to that. I'm looking forward to it, actually, because I haven't heard it since we actually did it. My only recollection of it was worth listening to. Hopefully it is. We'll get to that in a second. Here's another one of our guests who's been on this program many, many, many times over the years. Usually when there's war, rarely during peace times in the National Football League. Richard Berthelsen is now the former legal counsel for the National Football League Players Association. On Thursday of last week, Richard stepped down from that post after 40 years with the PA, and he joins us on the telephone. Richard, how are you? Richard, are you with us? I'm not hearing him. Is he hearing us? Richard, can you hear us? No, we've seemed to have lost the line, or... we're going to try and get him back. Somewhere between there and here, we lost him. This is a guy who's seen an awful lot over the course of the last 40 years. So you're dating back to, what, 1972?
Mm-hmm.
A time when Pete Rozelle would have been the commissioner of the National Football League, when the NFL certainly was beyond its infancy, but a time when, from a collective bargaining position, things were really starting to happen. Guys were starting to really make some serious money. We've reconnected. Richard, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can.
Good of you to join us. Thank you very much for your time. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Sorry about that little cell phone glitch there. I was, I thought I was holding, but I guess we were disconnected.
That's quite all right. It happens. Your decision to step down on Thursday, 40 years on the job, I assume something that you didn't have to debate too long about. You had decided that now was the time?
There wasn't much of a debate. For me, it was getting through this last negotiation
right. For
the agreement that we ended up signing on August 4th and doing my part in implementing that agreement for the first year. 65 is kind of the target date for our people for retirement. And I'm a couple years past that, so makes a lot of sense, especially for May 15th, which was actually the first day I ever went to work back in 1972.
Wow.
It was exactly 40 years.
We were just briefly beginning to chat about 1972 and the era and the time. What are your recollections of when you came to the PA? Certainly, we were past the formative stages of the NFL. It was big time by 1972. But economically, free agency really hadn't hit in professional sport, although it was about to. The landscape was about to change very dramatically in all sports, not the least of which was football.
Right. When I started, the average salary was somewhere around $24,000, but more significantly, the player's share of all the revenues was less than 30%, and we have over 50%, and the average salary is over $2 million, so there's been quite a lot of change. But when I started, I just took a leave of absence from a law firm for 3 years. The issue was free agency. And the players just filed the Mackey case, the lawsuit that challenged the Rozelle rule. I was naive enough to think that maybe in a 3-year period I'd go help them attain free agency and then go back to practicing law. Pretty naive at the time.
Mm.
But it took us until 1993 for us to achieve that. So it was a much more of a challenge than any of us ever thought it would be.
Richard, you sat across the table from three pretty significant figures in the three NFL commissioners, Pete Rozelle, Paul Tagliabue, and excuse me, just fill in there for me.
Define if you can. I think this is where Stephen was going. Define if you can the difference between the commissioners. Was there a fundamental difference?
Literally, we didn't really sit across from Pete Rozelle. The lawyers and the owners' committee took over when Pete was commissioner. And I think if Pete actually had been at the table and if he were in charge of labor relations, I think we would have resolved differences sooner. He was a man that I liked, but they kind of pushed him aside when it came to our issues. Paul Tagliabue was just the opposite. He took over full control of labor relations, and as a result, I think one of the best things he ever did was to achieve an agreement with us, which he did within 4 years of taking office, that lasted for so long. We originally agreed in 93 to a system that would have a salary cap and free agency, and we extended that agreement on multiple occasions, resulting in us having almost 17 years of labor peace, which was unprecedented not only in football but in all sports. Roger, on the other hand, more of a businessman, a very good one at that. And in the end, Roger, I think, probably applied lessons that he'd learned from both Pete Rozelle and Paul. And fortunately, we were able to put things together last year without missing any significant games. We just missed the one exhibition game, the Hall of Fame game. So the fans were able to see nearly all of their football last year, and we were able to put it all together.
I've met Pete Rozelle. I've spent some time with Paul Tagliabue. I've not had an opportunity to talk to Goodell. I suppose Tagliabue I found the most interesting because he was almost like the cheese in the sandwich. I look at Goodell and I see a modern day Pete Rozelle, a guy with a presence, a willingness to be in front of the media and out front of stories, not shy of being a public figure. Where Tagliabue, I thought he was more of a behind the scenes kind of. His preference would have been, let me do this behind the scenes and not worry that much about being in front of the camera. Was that your experience?
Well, Paul is a no-nonsense type. He was a very practical, pragmatic. He was the chief antitrust lawyer for the league when we had our lawsuits in the 70s. He saw from a very close proximity that the legal issues were important, and that if you could resolve our issues and compromise with the players, that it would be good for everybody and that we could form a partnership. And I give Paul a lot of credit. I think he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and hopefully he will be soon. But I agree that Roger kind of combines maybe the best of both Paul and Pete. And he's a pragmatist. He's a businessman. He knows the importance of the bottom line and making the negotiations work for both sides. In the end, I thought his role was extremely productive with us.
Richard, we just have about a minute here. Do you think the conversation going forward, as you now leave the NFLPA, it's a lot of this we've talked about money and about dividing the revenues of the game. How much of the conversation going in the immediate future especially is going to be not about money but about player safety?
Well, hopefully most of it. There's been too little attention paid to the improvements that we've made in player safety. My hope, if I were to talk to somebody I've worked with 5, 6, 7 years from now, is that the best news is going to be that average careers have increased. We did a lot in that direction. We reduced significantly the amount of time players have to spend in the off-season, and even when they have their off-season training now, there's very little so-called teamwork. We've reduced the chance for there to be hits and injuries in the off season. That carries over into the preseason and the regular season. And if you can actually count up the number of hits that players will not have anymore as a result of the changes that we've made, and hopefully that's going to prolong their careers. The game, the economics are well set. The players have essentially preserved their piece of the pie. Our focus now has to be on keeping them safe.
Richard, thank you very much for the opportunity to chat with you over the years. We wish you health and success as you move on to other things at this point in your life. And we enjoyed talking to you again today. Thank you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed being on.
Richard Bertelsen, former legal counsel for the National Football League Players Association. And it will be interesting to see whether the NFLPA and the league itself can work together functionally to make a safer environment for these players, because it's been an issue for some period of time, but it continues to be an issue. And unfortunately, as we see in other sports, too seldom do these two sides who sit on opposite sides of the table on almost every issue, too seldom are they able to come together on things that matter to both of them. And this is something that matters to both of them. And I'm hopeful that somehow now, finally, they can bridge that gap.
I guarantee you that's going to be the conversation. We're not going to be talking about collective agreements and money in the NFL for a long time now, but you're going to be hearing a lot about player safety, and it's for a whole bunch of reasons.
Again, our thanks to Richard Bertelsen. When we come back, one of the last conversations with Burt Randolph Sugar, interestingly enough, it was not about boxing, or very little of it, as I recollect, was about boxing, but mostly about a time in Burt's life when he was a madman or an ad man, when he worked on Madison Avenue in New York City, you know, in the same era as the Mad Men TV show situates itself. Some reflections of one of our last conversations with Burt Randolph Sugar when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius and Sportsnet. Nineteen before the hour. For those of you who heard the music, I believe on radio, it is the theme from Mad Men, and it is only appropriate. Yesterday, we lost one of our favorite people, one of our favorite guests on this program. Well, my favorite. He's at the top of the list. Burt Randolph Sugar passed away. And we thought today, even though we've talked a little bit about him earlier today, we thought what we would do is take you back. I don't know if we've ever done this for anybody. But take you back and let you listen to Burt Randolph Sugar. He was the consummate professional, the consummate entertainer. This was August the 5th, 2011. And Burt grew up, went to school at Michigan, got his law degree, and then went to Madison Avenue in New York to become an ad man. At the same time, in the early 60s, where the TV series Mad Men is set. And I don't know how, but somehow we got talking about it. Do you or have you watched Mad Men?
Oh, yes.
And?
It's understated.
Understated, really?
We were worse.
Worse. Worse.
There was one agency I was in, the drinking was so bad, they actually put a bar on the 14th floor called The Meeting. So if somebody called your wife or you were in The Meeting.
He's in The Meeting.
You were drunk. And then you get on the bar car coming home of the train, and it got worse.
Well, I do have a few stories myself of ad agencies here in Toronto from the 70s, not the 60s, but the 70s, but early 70s, of a group of guys who regularly on Friday afternoons, well, they take Fridays off, would rent a limousine and drive up and down one of the main boulevards in Toronto, mooning people in $3,000 suits, by the way.
That was about right. There was a group in New York. It was the Fifth. It was called Fatwa, and it had nothing to do with the Muslim world.
Yeah.
Fifth Avenue, and I won't say the word, but it's a mammary reference.
Yes.
The T, Watchers Association.
Ah.
These were $200,000 and $300,000 a year CBS executives that stood out on the sidewalk comparing girls and their projections all lunch period. Others were chasing the two-legged wildlife. I mean, it was just, it was a last frontier Wild West type of approach, and yet you came out with great commercials.
What agency or agencies did you work for? I mean, it was big ones, right?
Yeah, McCann Erickson.
Right.
J. Walter Thompson.
The biggest.
Darcy McManus, Macias, Wynn Williams, Street and Finney. I mean, all those guys came together on one little plaque.
Yeah.
About two others, Papert Koenig Lois, which we called Stillman's East because there are always fist fights going on. And there were all kinds of funny things going on at all times. I'll give you one of the stories quickly. Panasonic had a TV set in the 60s. And at that point, Americans were not buying anything Japanese except cameras and TV sets. And Panasonic didn't sound Japanese, which it was. So it couldn't take advantage of the disadvantage. So there was one copywriter who came in with an ad, and he showed it to the Japanese clients. And what did it say? The headline, "From those wonderful people who gave you Pearl Harbor."
Seriously?
He was fired. The agency was fired. Other than that, it was good.
Holy cow.
you know, it's just people did things. It was just a wonderful, wonderful world. And the stories were unbelievable. The games that people played. The only thing I found correct in Mad Men was the fact that each secretary had a Selectric, an IBM Selectric in those days. It was a new thing.
Wow.
And you knew the secretary was gone for the day when she put, as they did in the show, her cover on the typewriter. She could be at the desk putting makeup on or at the water cooler or talking to her girlfriends down the hall. You go out with a piece of paper, Miss Jones, to hell with it. Because the cover was on the Selectric.
the plastic cover, I remember them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was the... You know, that was her mark. She's through. She doesn't care if the world came to an end. She's off. And you accepted it. You know, but there was a show that came out in 1963 that sort of epitomized advertising in that era. It's from How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Right.
The song was, "A secretary is not a toy. No, my boy, not a toy. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da." But the girls got back for all the overtures made in 1965 when we had a blackout down in New York Eastern Grid. They were asking guys that had been hitting on them for days, months, years, who knew, come on up to my apartment. It's on the 35th floor of the building on Park Avenue, knowing
the elevators don't work.
Attack. The elevators
aren't
working.
It's classic.
So that was the life I'm trying to get to, as well as the history of advertising, which is very, very fruitful and very, very storytelling. I mean, just very quickly, one story. 1946. Tony comes out with a first hair permanent for girls.
Oh, okay.
And the headline, which was a teasing headline, is "Which Twin Has the Tony?" One of the great headlines. And the FTC down here in America, the Federal Trade Commission, found that while one of the girls of the two in the picture did do her own hair at home, a home perm, both had gone to a salon and a hairdresser after that, before the commercial
show. Aha, so no truth in that advertising.
oh, wait a minute. Did that stop any of it?
No. Never.
So, you know, advertising is fun. To me, it's, you know, its definition is it functions to make the general public, through persuasion, think it has longed all its life for something it had never heard of before.
You know what I miss in advertising? I miss jingles.
Oh,
you don't get great jingles anymore. When I was a kid growing up, I could probably sing you 50 jingles from commercials, probably knew as many of them as I did songs on the radio.
I'm Chiquita Banana, and I've come to say bananas have to ripen in a certain way. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. Did you write that one?
No. Hello, everybody. Hello. There were some great ones back then, but my favorite, and I always remember it, first time I ever heard it, Pepsi Cola hits a spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot. twice as much for your money to PepsiCo is a drink for you. Nickel, 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 nickel.
You'll wonder where the yellow went if you brush your teeth with
Pepsodent.
Thank you.
And Bob Hope would come on. Hello, this is Bob, Pepsodent Hope.
He would. That's true, yeah.
Everybody,
every show had a sponsor, right?
Everybody identified with it. J-Lo, everybody, J-Lo. That was Jack Benny. But my favorite of all the shows, sponsor-wise, was the one that came on Tuesday night, which started with, oh, we're the men from Texaco. We work from Maine to Mexico. There's nothing like this Texaco of ours. Our show tonight is powerful. Why you with an hour full of showers from a shower full of starts? We're the merry Texacomen. Tonight we may be showmen. Tomorrow we'll be servicing your cars. Here's Milton Berle.
Berle. I miss those days. Why don't we have jingles anymore?
We don't have good advertising anymore, if you think about it.
Well, not like that. I mean, you know, it sounds corny, I'm sure, to the, you know, the younger generation. But there was more creativity in advertising back then.
Maybe drink is what did it.
Maybe you have to be sloshed in order to come up with all that stuff. Oh, huh?
I'll tell you a quick story, as long as we're here. Three of us went to lunch at a very Tony restaurant in New York when I was at McCann.
Okay.
And in the 60s, lunch was $100 minimal. And we're sitting there, and three of us, and we have trying to do something for Coca-Cola, and one of the guys, Bill Backer, says, well, it rhymes with harmony. This is after about six martinis, you know, the James Bond martinis, stirred,
yeah,
not shaken. And I don't know what the hell rhymes with harmony. Write it down on the tablecloth. So I wrote it down on the tablecloth, and one of the maitre d's runs over, you can't do that. That's an expensive damask tablecloth. I'll go away. So about two martinis later, the three of us, throwing in words, came up with, no music, we will teach the world
to sing. In perfect harmony.
Here comes that word, harmony. It's the real thing. And we called the agency, no cell phones. It was a dime over there on the phone.
Right.
Come and pay $300 for the tablecloth. They're asking for it. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Because we've done the work. It's over.
Yeah. You know, we'll see you when we see you. We sober up.
Well, and how giant was that campaign, right?
Oh, you know, you did things and they became so because maybe saying this, advertising was more of the pop culture than it is today. Today it's celebrity driven. You know, what did Brad Pitt do? Did he scratch his left cheek or right? Who cares?
Yeah.
But back then, advertising was part of our culture.
Oh, it was. It was as much entertainment as the shows themselves.
And
was really integrated into the shows.
Oh,
it was a part of it. It wasn't like when the commercials came on, it didn't necessarily mean it was time to get up and have a beer. You know what I mean? Or go to the fridge. You wanted to watch.
You got to watch those cigarette packs with long legs dancing around.
Well, or the Marlboro man, you know, on his horse.
Well, let me tell you a story. That was 63. Leo Burnett out of Chicago.
Yeah.
Was
big
given,
agency.
Yeah, you know, great agency, by the way. He was given an assignment by Philip Morris. They had this woman's cigarette, had a red tip, a silver tip, and a red coloring. I mean, it was going nowhere. Remake this cigarette. So they went out and they got a cowboy. It was Charlie Conley, the quarterback for the Giants, New York Giants. Put a tattoo on him, sat him on a horse smoking, and bought the music from Magnificent Seven. Dun, dun, dun,
yeah,
da, 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 da,
that's
da.
Right.
Became the biggest selling cigarette in the world.
Wait a second. That was Charlie Connerly?
Yes.
Charlie Connerly, who played in the 1958 greatest game ever played?
Yes.
Wow.
It was Charlie
I didn't know that.
Well, here, see, Pete Rozelle, head of the NFL.
Yeah.
And Jack Landry, not Tom, Jack Landry, head of Philip Morris Promotion, both started out of University of San Francisco, handing out cigarettes for Philip Morris as free gifts to passersby. They became big friends. So when Jack Landry needed somebody, he went to Pete Rozelle.
Wow,
this is fun, and it's for those people who, like you and I, come from that era. It sort of opens up mental windows. It's like, you know, this was part of our lives.
All right, back to your Underwood.
All right.
Or your IBM Selectric, whatever you're typing on.
It's a Smith Corona. It's
nice.
You know, it's what I've always worked on.
There, listen to him. He is typing. Burt Randolph Sugar. Wow. You hadn't heard that before.
No, that's a great way. I think there was a little bit of Mad Men talk on an interview when I was here, and I think you wanted to follow up on it. But that's fantastic. Let me tell you a story. How many times did he say that?
3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, that's Burt.
And he didn't end it the way he always ended, although we probably edited it out. Let's do this again sometime. Oh, if we could, Burt. See you tomorrow.